Duck, duck, goose! The Duck of Minerva in stereo.
Hello, and welcome to the 17th installment of the Duck of Minerva podcast. This episode features Ivor Newman, who is the Montague Burton Professor of International Relations at the London School of Economics. He is, among many works, the author of Russia and the Idea of Europe, A Study in Identity and International Relations, Uses of the Other, The East in European Identity Formation, Governing the Global Polity, Practice Mentality Rationality, which was co-authored with Ole Jacob Sending, and At Home with the Diplomats, Inside a European Foreign Ministry, which was published by Cornell University Press in 2012. Hi, this is Dan Nexon, and I am speaking to Ivor Newman. Ivor, are you there?
I am here. Hello.
Thank you so much for agreeing to do this recording at what is 9 a.m. my time, but significantly later your time.
Well, you know, it's 3 o'clock on a Friday, then Christmas is almost here. I'm good.
I know, you can feel the holiday spirit in the air.
Well, we lived in a log timber house from 1906. You know, if you can't get the Christmas spirit up with red painted walls and snow in the air outside, I suppose you never can.
My wife and I actually spent a Christmas Eve party. It wasn't Christmas Eve, but a Christmas party at your house some years ago. I remember lots of glug. Is that what you call it?
Oh, yes, yes. Anyway, the local variant of Glühwein.
It was, it was better than the stuff we'd gotten outside of your house, but still wasn't really to my tastes.
No, it's terrible, but on the other hand, it turns the trick.
So I thought that the best way to maybe segue into a discussion of your intellectual biography is to mention that you have recently taken up the Montague Chair at the London School of Economics, which is, as I understand it, quite an honor. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, Dan.
What is the Montague Chair exactly?
Well, Montague Burton is a taken name. The man was born in Latvia in 1891 and made it over to Britain and basically was a self-made man in the confectionery business. And as a good arrivist, you know, he spent some of that money on gifts to academia. So there's a Montague Burton Professor of IR in Oxford as well as in the LSE. And there's one in industrial relations in both places as well. So that's been good. And since I know you're a film buff, you probably remember the film The Full Monty. Mm-hmm. And the reason why that film is called that is probably that after the Second World War, when the Brits were decommissioned, they were set up with a three-piece suit, which was actually sort of it came out of the Montague Burton works, as it were. So hence the full Monty used to mean that you were well-dressed. Of course, in the film, it means that you're not dressed at all. So it's an interesting inversion there.
So I always hate to sort of, I mean, you are an incredibly productive scholar and you have years of productivity ahead of you. And yet the Montague Chair does seem like kind of the climax of a very successful, but also somewhat winding intellectual and academic trajectory. So maybe you could take us back a bit and talk a little bit about your academic biography.
Well, why not? And I think you are polite when you say winding, because a friend... usually sort of when he's forced to characterize me, he says that I'm manic digressive, which I think is more to the point. But there is method in the madness, and I suppose you will see why when I start by saying that I grew up in a typical academic family. My father was a professor of geology, and my mother was a dentist, and more to the point, he was also the head of the natural science department at the University of Oslo. So the house was always teeming with natural scientists. And I actually did my A-levels in maths and physics. But somehow those subjects didn't come alive for me. It was always politics and literature and politics. So The first time I had the chance to do something myself, I applied for the Army Language Russian course, which is an outgrowth of the Monterey course. You know, this was in 1978, and I had to do my conscription. So I picked up Russian for 2 years, and that turned out to be a fateful choice, because once you have a language under your belt, of course you want to do stuff where you can use it.
So having learned Russian in the military, how did you use it besides some escapades in Moscow?
Well, I was there for half a year, yes, working for the Norwegian Minister of Foreign Affairs. That's proved to be a harbinger of things to come. But I actually first settled for a master's thesis in English Lit and Lang. And the reason for that was that we had a system then when we did a number of different topics for our undergraduate degree. I did social anthropology, I did Russian, of course, and I did English, and I did political sciences as a fourth option. And when time came to choose, I went for the English Lit and Lang. But then, you know, it turned out this was the desperately traditional department where I wasn't allowed to do this and wasn't allowed to do that. My first idea for a thesis was to look at Brave New World, which and then I was told that Huxley had been so-and-so during the war. And I said, what the heck has that got to do with his literature? But, you know, these things just didn't materialize. Then I wanted to do a close reading of what happens to a piece of art when it goes from being sort of presented in one genre to another. And I picked, you know, as high a ground I could. I picked Harold Pinter's screenplay for the John Fowles novel, The French Lieutenant's Woman. And again, I was told that this wasn't anglistics. So at this point, I just said, bugger you, and decided to do a master's in political science instead.
And the rest, as they say, is history. So you did your master's in political science, and this was in Norway then?
Yes, it was.
Uh-huh. But
I did the same thing I ever did. I decamped for Britain because the stuff that was taught at the University of Oslo in those days was one of the many fallouts of your Marshall Plan, Dan, where the idea was to give a lot of money to Europeans so that they should be inundated in ways American, and it worked. So the political science we were taught was very much American political science. And I learned a lot, but it wasn't what I wanted to do. I wanted to do theoretically and historically informed stuff about lived life in general. I was not particularly thrilled by that high-end stuff. And that would, of course, also be because during my A-levels, I had done mathematics and I'd done well at it, but I didn't quite see what the relevance was of all that to lived social life, actually.
So your first big work was Uses of the Other, and was that your doctoral dissertation?
Actually, no, and it's interesting that you should say that, because my first work coming out of the doctorate was a book called Russia and the Idea of Europe, which was more or less the doctoral thesis with an updated chapter at the end there. It was basically... Well, I would have liked to say genealogy now, but it's more of a standard history, really, and history of ideas of how Russians discussed Europe, and by discussing Europe, discussed themselves. So it was a very implicit theoretical work, to put it kindly. I mean, this was an Oxford DPhil, and you weren't supposed to be too equilibrious when it came to theory, but. That book got a lot of traction in Russian studies and also in nationalist studies, but it had little reception in IR. And so it's typical that you haven't even heard of it. And what I did to remedy that, to take the themes and broaden them, take the one chapter that I'd taken out from the thesis when it became a book, which was the theory chapter, and then sort of plonk it into the IR debate as a general book on identity from a self-other perspective.
Before we get into that, I do want to ask you a little bit more about your D-fill, because one of the things that that one of my dissertation advisors, Ira Katznelson, always used to say is that if you wanted to understand the field, you should look at the acknowledgments in first books and you should trace who advised whom. And this is something that Patrick Jackson is now trying to do a project on in one of those sort of notional back of a napkin, I'll do this eventually. I think that there's actually some work underway, but it won't be bear fruit for quite some time. So who were your advisors at Oxford?
Well, my first advisor was a man called Lucas Tuklis. And after the first 6 weeks of term, I went to Lucas and said, Lucas, I believe the other people in my MPhil class are receiving tutorials, but we never see one another. And Lucas said, you want tutorials? You want tutorials? Ah, in that case, I will set you up with one of my doctoral students. And let's say it was a Greek approach to teaching. And Lucas was a very nice man who formed me in the sense that he gave me perspectives on European integration that I still carry with me. But I don't think you can count him amongst my key intellectual influences. That would definitely have been John Vincent, who was teaching an MPhil class in classical theories of international relations. We read up on everything from Victoria and Suarez, the old Spanish international lawyers, through people like Hobbes, Grotius, Victoria. Well, you see where this is leading. And basically, everyone who had been talking about international relations before it became, and at any depth before it became an academic pursuit. And that course, John had taken off the hands of Hedley Bull. It was, and Hedley Bull had in turn fashioned it on Martin White's approach to teaching international relations. So you mentioned Patrick Jackson's project on who's the supervisor to whom. I think we should think of this as a multi-generational project. It's often not enough to ask who's your supervisor. You have to ask who's your supervisor's supervisor.
This is what he talks about in terms of, you know, intellectual great-grandparents and great-great-grandparents. So I think it does have this notion of kind of tracing the temporal network, temporal and spatial networks of influence in the field. So.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so you were saying that your grandfather, your dissertation's grandfather, as it will, was Hedley Bull.
Definitely. And in this case, this was an intentional choice on my part, because one of the few texts that I read that I really enjoyed during my political science years in Oslo was Hedley Bull's The Anarchical Society. So I went to Oxford in order to become part of the English School of International Relations, actually.
So we were at then the point where you had written this book on Russia and the idea of Europe, which sounds vaguely familiar perhaps from my days studying nationalism as an undergraduate, but you're right, I haven't really encountered in any sustained way, to the book that I think really put you on the map for a lot of people in international relations, which was Uses of the Other, which even people in the United States who never, at least if they were active in the 90s, who have never read any kind of critical or post-structural or anything with a capital T theory attached to it, have generally heard of this particular book. So why don't you tell us a little bit about Uses of the Other and how it came to be out of this one theory chapter of your dissertation?
Well, you see, what happened there was while I wrote my doctorate, I came across the texts by people like Ashley, Walker, Derderian, and John was the one who introduced me to Derderian, actually, because John had a hand in the publication of On Diplomacy when Oxford University Press did like it. John actually took it over and literally sort of carried it over to Blackwell's, which is Blackwell's publishers, which is also based in Oxford, and said, you have to publish this book. So I knew of it from there. But, you know, once I started reading, with my already fleeting knowledge of Foucault and also Nietzsche, this was just spot on for me, and I never looked back. So the most important intellectual experience I had at Oxford was actually a reading experience, I would say, with hindsight. Excuse me. And then the first thing that happened there when I wanted to apply these ideas to IR was that I wrote a paper while I was still a doctoral student called Russia as Eastern Europe's Constitutive Other. And the basic thing that spurred me on was that in my thesis I looked at all the stupid representations that Russians had made of Europeans, and I somehow felt that I owed it to the Russians to look at how the stupid representations that other people had made of them. So I looked at how people like Milan Kundera and other Central Europeans had used Russia in order to forge a community between themselves. And that article came out in an area studies journal called East European Politics and Society. And that was basically my first stab at looking at self-other relations in addition to the ones I'd looked at in my thesis. And then when those two went down so well, I thought, well, what the heck, why not make a book on this?
And what would you say that just for those of us who are, well, not those of us, those listeners who are unfamiliar with uses of the other, how would you kind of summarize the argument?
Well, the basic idea was to take this insight from anthropology, which is that a collective is not a collective first and foremost because they speak the same language, wear the same clothes, eat the same food, etc. But that what it's about is looking at how they sustain their otherness and their distinctiveness along the borders. And of course, I mean not only the geographical but also the social borders towards outsiders. So the idea of what post-structuralists would call the constitutive outside, that the two of us are basically males, among other things, because we're not females. I mean, we do a lot of things to mark socially that we're not females, and females do the same thing. So that what is outside us is basically limiting us off from what we don't want to be, and we are who we are because of that. And that was the basic insight that I ran with. And then where most of the other post-structuralists of the day were basically sitting around theorizing this, was a bit like the situation in gender studies now, where post-structuralists basically write footnotes to Judith Butler's work instead of doing empirical stuff. I said, okay, let's now look at how this actually plays out. We're supposed to be social scientists, not philosophers. So I applied this insight in identity to a number of empirical sequences. And since my two geographical areas of expertise have always been Russia and Scandinavia, I suppose that would be Northern Europe, that's where I did the work.
And I'm looking at the publication date of Uses of the Other with Minnesota Press, which is 1998, which seems a little late. It had come out with a press in Britain before then, is that correct?
Nope. I thought it was 1999, actually, but if you say so, it's probably 1998. But let's not forget that I finished my doctorate in December 2002. And at this point, I was working, had been working even while I was a student in Oxford, actually, at the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs. Mm-hmm. And you will recall that my specialty, which was Soviet EU relations and then Russian European relations, was a field that was not exactly neglected by the press in those days. We are talking about the fall of Eastern Europe. And I'd done some work on Soviet-Eastern Europe relations. Then the fall of the Soviet Union, and then the reconfiguration of Russian-European relations. So since I worked in a think tank, I was basically sort of being interviewed and had to write op-eds all of the time. So a lot of time simply went on updating myself on what was going on there on a day-to-day basis, and also talking to the press. So I was a big-time public intellectual for 4 or 5 years there in my native Norway. And these things take time. You know, they detract time from your writing. So Russia and the idea of Europe wasn't out, I believe, before 1995, I think it was. And then, of course, I had to write a couple more things for Uses of the Other before it could be published.
So you spent a great deal of time of your professional career at the Norwegian Institute for International Affairs, or NUPI, as the acronym is in Norwegian. Although, I guess if you were to say NUPI in Norwegian, it wouldn't sound the same, would it?
Oh, it would sound the same, all right. But yes, I've been in and out of there for my entire career, actually.
So that sort of raises kind of two interesting questions that are worth pursuing. The first is that I think that for many American listeners, it will be a little bit of a shock to think that here is somebody who did a lot of deeply policy relevant work and spent a good deal of your time either in a policy environment at the Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs or writing for a public audience, but who also is in many ways international relations associated with very theoretically complex arguments like Foucauldian arguments or practice term arguments, and who has written translations of work by difficult French theorists into Norwegian and things like that. So how did that, so that for many Americans will seem like an unusual juxtaposition. How do you think it's informed your work?
Well, one of the great things about growing up amongst academics is that the way academics speak is simply natural to you. This is an enormous privilege when you start university that you don't have to think about socializing yourself along some model. This is your world already. And then it's also easy to take in what I think should be the basic academic adage, which is say things as simple as possible, but not simpler. And that's what I've always tried to do. And I must say, Dan, that when I look at some of my fellow Foucauldians, I get this feeling that they're trying to write like Foucault. And I think Foucault would have been furious at them because the point to him was not that you should write like him, but that you should write like yourself. And if you look at the interviews Foucault gave, he was super clear. It's very, very hard to mistake what he's saying. He's going dang, 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 dang. So I must say that if I have one criticism of post-structuralism in IR, it is that there is too much unnecessary fluff when it comes to how people express their basic ideas.
So out of this, so one question is sort of this intersection of these areas we normally think of as distinctive, and it sounds to me like you're saying they're really not. It's a matter of expressing yourself clearly and not getting wrapped up in a kind of pseudo-intellectual jargon that is sometimes associated with the worst impulses in academia. And the flip side of that is that I know that it's also in this period that you really became a kind of idea leader or got to a lot of things that the field would get to but got to them earlier. One of the things I'm thinking about is the way that now you're seen very much as a kind of proto or one of the first people to have done work on the practice turn. So that might be something that you could tell us a little bit about.
Well, my interest in politics from day one was an interest in how people live differently. And in order to find out how people live differently, you don't start with models of the world and decide how it all hangs together. You have a look at what they're doing. And you know, to me, it's almost impossible to understand how, for example, you can do a large N study of something that is going on in places where you haven't even been. That's not social science. You should be hands-on. You should know what's going on. And that's also why I have this interest in applied work, because if you sit there with knowledge of what is actually going on in somewhere like, for example, Russia, and the number of people are interested, it's not only that you can earn your keep by knowing this, but it's also that I feel that you have some kind of a duty to the country where you work to chime in on all this, just like you have a duty to the country where you work to criticize the political setup when you think it's wrong. So so to me, that was basically a kind of intellectual conscription, if you like. Excuse me. the interesting thing was that when it came to, for example, lecturing for military people, which I did a lot in the 1990s because Norway was then a heavy contributor to peace operations. And some of the places they wanted to go would be places where I could tell them stuff. For example, the Balkans. And you have no idea how nice it is to have military men as students because they know that their lives may depend on what you tell them. So they're all ears. And another thing is that they know full well that identity is a key phenomenon of politics that they have to relate to because that's one of the reasons why people kill one another. And that's maybe one of the reasons why they may kill you. I mean, that is the military student. So paradoxically, what I found in the 1990s with that my so-called colleagues at the University of Oslo denied that identity was relevant to security politics in the first place, whereas the Ministry of Defense and the military and the Ministry of Foreign Affairs sought me out in order to debate these things. So, and even that didn't make any impression on the people over at the Department of Political Science at the University of Oslo. So, you know, one wonders what is going on inside the heads of certain of our colleagues then.
So one of the things that happened along the way was that you also acquired a doctorate in another area of study. Is that correct?
Well, you see, what happened was that in around 1994, I was basically sick and tired of doing Russia. And that was there were a couple of reasons. One more mundane reason was that I had to drink a lot while I was in Russia. And interviewing in Russia is very hard because with the males, you basically have to drink before you get proper information, or else, you know, they can't sort of be certain that you respect them, and then they don't really want to talk to you on a basic deep level, which means that I always came home from those trips feeling extremely worse for wear. But the other thing was that the action in Moscow and the rest of the country was moving from politics to economics. One of the things, and one of the great things about being a political scientist studying the Soviet Union during the Cold War was that there was no specific economic sphere in the Soviet Union. It was all politics. So economics were basically a derivative of politics, which meant that you held the field when you were a political scientist. Now, with the rise of the oligarch and all the hanky-panky surrounding the relationship between Yeltsin and the oligarchs, more and more of the action disappeared into the economic sphere, where I didn't have the tools to follow it. So these were two of the reasons that conspired to put me off being a sort of running commentator on Russia in those years. And the third one was that I simply tired of always guessing at what should happen tomorrow. That is an intellectually poor pursuit because you will get the answer tomorrow anyway. You know, so you know, sitting around endlessly talking about what will happen tomorrow is, of course, of key importance to diplomats and it's of key importance to politicians. But it is not what I would think of as an intellectual pursuit. So I basically had it with Russia. And then the question was, what next? And then I thought, okay, I'm interested in politics as it is lived, and I'm doing international relations. Where are international relations formulated? Well, one standard answer to that would be at the top level, where politicians discuss what foreign policy should be. Sorry. And that's fair enough, but on the quotidian level, it's diplomats that are foremost among the people who make the sort of world of international relations go around. So I decided to do a study on diplomacy, and that was my postdoc. And I won a Jean Monnet Fellowship to do it. And I came down there and I started reading up on the I continued reading up on the political science literature on diplomacy. And the study was supposed to be on Coreper, which is the place where the representatives of the European Union countries come together in Brussels to settle most of the stuff that happens in the EU. And I decided after a while that I couldn't do this stuff because what I wanted to do in terms of describing what diplomacy was and what diplomats actually did was impossible with the tools that were then available to a political scientist. So I decided to go back and retrain as a social anthropologist in order to do this. And, well, that took a while. It took 17 years from when I started that and until the second doctorate and the book coming out of it. There. So it was a long haul then.
Now, the book that has come out came out this year, although we're heading towards we're very close to the end of the year now, but thankfully not the apocalypse.
Well, we don't know yet. This day isn't over, isn't it? Is it?
There was a great tweet that's been going around about this, to the extent of, you know, the Mayans used to believe that if you painted kids blue and threw them into caverns, you could bring rain. Why should we listen to anything they have to say about the cosmological order? Which I think pretty much sums up my attitude toward this. But the book that came out this year, At Home with the Diplomats, Inside a European Foreign Ministry, has been very well received. And I thought that would be a good thing for you to plug a little bit for us, since you've just been talking about the long journey from notion to product for this work.
Yep. One of the things about discourse analysis, which was what I'm most on Russia and Russian foreign policy and Russian identity formation, is that you are forever studying the prerequisites and presuppositions and the preconditions for action. You don't get around to studying the actions themselves. And that is not because of Foucault, who was the father of discourse analysis, but it's because of the Anglo-American reception of the method that he used, which was discourse analysis. But to Foucault himself, the preconditions for action were important because you could study the actions by looking at the preconditions for actions. So I thought, okay, time to take the jump and stop only reading texts and looking at the preconditions for how things actually come about. Let me look at the actions themselves. And the idea there was not to kiss goodbye to preconditions for action. I mean, they were very much there and had to be there in place, but to complement that by looking at patterns of action. And the things to me came together in the idea of practice, and not practice with an X, not the old Marxist idea of practice, but practice as understood by people like Wittgenstein and, well, Foucault himself. So what I did was I let it be known around Oslo that I wanted to work for a stint in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. And always a small place, and there aren't all that many people who know stuff about international relations at a certain level. So after only half a year, I was invited to become a planner in the ministry. So I worked there for 2 years, and the idea was that I would be able to write on diplomacy as well. So I took field notes, not about substance, of course, because that would have been impossible and illegal, but on how diplomats go about their work, how they write texts, how they talk to one another, what they do when they set up meetings, etc., etc., etc. And then I was there again for 1.5 years. And on top of all that, I was invited to write the centenary history of the Norwegian Minister of Foreign Affairs. So all in all, I ended up spending 5.5 years in there, and adding the half year that I was at the Moscow embassy in 1980, I was there for 6 years. And the result was the, I think, world's first ever ethnography of national diplomacy. So the book, At Home with the Diplomat, is, I think this is typical for my work, falls in two parts. First, the historical preconditions, would in this case be what is diplomacy, and let's not forget that it's not only the ambassador who travels around on embassies who was the origin of diplomacy. It also has other origins, and the most important of those would be the scribe who was sitting at home and taking down what the king and his men wanted to have done in the area of foreign policy. And it's interesting that the scribe, who is also the forerunner of the bureaucrat, is the dirty origin of diplomacy. And when diplomats talk about their work, they very rarely talk about that part, which is interesting because the average diplomat will spend more time at home, as they say, which means in their ministries of foreign affairs, than they will out on postings. So the first two chapters basically look at the emergence of diplomacy and the emergence of foreign ministries. And the rest of the chapters look at what diplomats do when they're at home.
So you were talking about the book, and one of the things that immediately leaps to mind is that, you know, so this is a really fantastic ethnographic and theoretically informed ethnographic account of not only sort of the genealogy of diplomacy, but of sort of the daily practice of diplomacy and the way that generates many things about many of the things that happen in diplomacy. But the standard kind of, you know, sort of mainstream international relations critique of this kind of work would be say, oh, you know, it's very interesting to, and interesting with scare quotes around it, to talk about the various kinds of practices that produce speeches and produce modes of thinking at kind of the mid-level of foreign ministry bureaucracy. But really the important decisions are made at the top, and the kind of stuff that goes into that washes away in the context of strategic bargaining or anarchical constraints or whatever your preferred way of thinking about how international politics is conducted. So what would you say to that kind of argument?
Well, that was one reaction from a good friend and colleague who is now the Montagu Burton professor at Oxford, mm-hmm. Andrew Hurrell, when I said that I wanted to do a project on diplomacy. And he put it in typical British parlance. He said, well, that will all crease out in the wash, won't it? So I suppose that would be the short way of making the point that you just made. And my answer would be twofold. I mean, my first answer would be that a social science is supposed to look at the form of the social phenomena that we're talking about. If we're interested in foreign policy and diplomacy, for example, we need to look at them as social forms, how they actually exist as specific ways of being in the world. And the second thing, which pertains more to the outcome side that you touched on, is that no action can come out of a social whole without a W, that is. It has to be grounded in the social possibilities that are there. And when Graham Allison talked about standard operational procedures, for example, he talked about a social phenomenon which setups and enables but also limits what decision makers can do. And the way you set up a foreign ministry and the way you order its work will be exactly the same thing. This is what neo-institutionalists are always going on about. So if you add up the form of the institution and the mindsets that are basically filling that institution's in the shape of envehicled humans, you have a mechanism that the top decision makers can play on. And if you add to this that most top decision makers will be shaped by that machine as well, you have a situation where it is, to me at least, unthinkable that the top leader can do anything he or she wants at any given time, because that's just not the way the social works. It is inconceivable that a top leader would suddenly do something that is totally out of style. And by the way, if she did, she would probably have the rest of her leadership and the rest of her department coming down on her like a ton of brick before she had the chance to put this into life. So to me, that is simply an asocial way of thinking.
So we've touched on a number of the areas, sort of places where you've had your imprint on emerging areas of study or modes of analysis in the field. What we're talking about now, we might term the new study of diplomacy, and it's a whole variety of work that includes not only you, but a lot of, but people who have been sort of firmly embedded in the kind of Bourdieusian practice term, and also includes people who are you've worked with in Norway, also includes some people who have looked much more at psychology, right, and cognitive psychology and social psychology to try to understand how the conduct, the process of interacting with other individuals shapes international politics. So you've had your kind of foot there, and as should be clear from the particular way that you've done it and some of the things we've said earlier, you've also had your imprint on the early phases of what we think of now as the practice turn. And I know that a lot of people who have been interested in kind of practices when they were kind of starting to do their work or involved in their work would go seek you out. So I remember Ted Hoff, you know, going to track you down at a conference to talk about practices with you while he was doing some of his work. But one of the things that you said earlier about the way that you approach practices, I thought was interesting, because a lot of the people who are now subconsciously doing practices with a capital P are either coming at it from a kind of a Bourdieusian milieu, right? Sort of the French tradition, as it were, but particularly the Bourdieu tradition. And then you have people who've really latched onto a pragmatist variant. And I think about some people at Frankfurt, maybe erroneously, as being an epicenter for some of the more pragmatist versions of practice analysis. But you talk about it much more embedded within people like Foucault, who, as you said earlier on, are traditionally thought of as sort of contributing in our field to discourse analysis, but pointing out in part that discourse analysis it was never really about free-floating text or speech. It was always about action, this category of action and practice. So I thought maybe you could talk a little bit more about what it means to come at this from a Foucauldian or a related perspective, rather than these two other perspectives that are kind of now most closely associated with practice turn work in IR.
Well, for one thing, when you look at Bourdieu, he's playing the French game of being top dog. What's the name of that children's game that you have where you basically just try to stand on top of a heap of snow or whatever?
King of the Hill.
King of the Hill. That's right. The French intellectual scene is a very hierarchical scene where the entire point is to be king of the hill. And Foucault was king of the hill when Bourdieu came along, and of course Bourdieu then proceeded to spend 50 years trying to become king of the hill himself. So in Bourdieu's work, you can see that it's seeped through with influences from Foucault. And I wouldn't go so far as to say that for each Bourdieusian concept, there would be a Foucauldian one that he tries to scupper. But it's not far from it, you know. Where Foucault talks about discourse, Bourdieu talks about field, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Bourdieu himself is coming out of a French tradition that has traditionally been infatuated with practices. So I don't think that my take on this is very different from the Bourdieusian take, simply because we both come out of the same stuff. As to pragmatism, it's interesting you should say that, because the reason why I wrote this 2002 article that has always been quoted as an early contribution to the practice turn in IR was that the journal Millennium had one of the sort of annual calls for a special issue, and it should be on pragmatism. And they wrote there that they would also welcome contributions on practices. And as we talked about before, at this time I was a bit miffed with discourse theory that never sort of came out of the reading chair, as it were. You know this whole idea of reading and reading and reading and reading texts in order to finding the preconditions for action is a very important work, but it left me a bit let's go and do something kind of thing. And so I had a stab at that. I had a stab at trying to demonstrate how Foucauldian discourse analysis could lead to textual discourse analysis on the one hand, or practice analysis on the other. And I tried to tie the two together by saying that discourse is looking at precondition for action. Then when action happens in forms of practice, the practice can uphold or it can undermine the discourse in question. So practices are instantiations of discourses that can verify or falsify that particular way of making a truth claim, as it were. And that article was my holiday project when I was hanging out with my family in the south of Norway for 4 weeks. I handed it in, it was accepted, and nothing happened for a year. And then Patty Goff came along and said, could I make a panel at the ISA on this article? And I tried to hide that I was extremely flattered by this and said, well, of course, Patty, if you have the time. And then she did, and along came people like Nick Onuf and Fritz Kratochvil. And, well, it was an interesting thing. And now that article has been in the reference in a number of places, up and down and back and forth. And when Emmanuel Adler and Vincent Pouliot did their edited volume on practices as a sort of statement thing, I was invited because of that article. So, yes, it made a minor splash. And it only goes to show that you never know what you write that will actually have an impact. You can spend 10 years on something and no one will notice. And then you can spend a month on something and there will be a reception.
Yes. And we could probably do an entire discussion of the sociology and practice of the field around that very idea. Another area that which I think I'm starting to see, if I hadn't already, or at least I can see within the realm of this interview, all the connections going on here, but another area that you've been, had a sort of minor splash, as you put it, would be within what might be termed second wave popular culture work in the field, right? So if the first wave was, you know, James Derderian, Mike Shapiro, et cetera, then there's a sort of second wave that very subconsciously develops carrying on that work. In the late 90s, early 2000s, and going forward, Jutta Weldes is one of the people here, but you are also one of the people here. And so why this interest in popular culture, and how does popular culture tie into these other things that you've been talking about?
Well, the precondition for action there, as it were, was that I abandoned my MPhil in English Lit and Lang. So when I was at this ISA conference, and I think the 1999 or 2000, I ran into two extremely intense young men one evening, and it was one of those conversations where you just started and we didn't know one another, and after a while you discovered that it was 3 hours later. And one of these guys was Patrick Jackson and the other one was you. And you basically wanted to talk about Star Trek, I remember, and it only so happened that my best friend was dating a Slovenian woman some years before and had invited her to come and be a guest researcher at the Department of Anthropology here in Oslo. And before that could be realized, he had found the woman that became his future wife. So he came to me and said, Ivar, is there any way that you can host her at the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs? And I said, well, you're my best friend, of course. I will talk to my family. And she ended up coming to the Norwegian Institute of International Affairs, and she ended up living with my family for a month while she was looking for a house in Oslo. And she brought with her a bag full of Star Trek videos. At this stage, I hadn't ever watched a Star Trek video. And when she left, I was hooked. So when I met the two of you at the ISA and you talked about Star Trek, well, I had some ideas there. And all this came together, the general interest in literature, the interest in Star Trek as the perhaps the most elaborate world that we know of an imagined world, as it were. I have always thought that the study of social sciences should be a study of as many worlds as possible. And there are really only three places to get. There is the contemporary world, otherness there. There is history, and there would be imagined world. And the key place for imagined worlds would be science fiction and fantasy. So hence my interests. And it offers some very interesting possibilities of thinking about how to organize life with more than one polity in play in situations where psychological and biological constraints that we know on this earth do not exist. So I think it's a deeply serious undertaking there. And you wouldn't disagree, would you?
Probably not. But this doesn't, however, explain Harry Potter.
Well, no, it doesn't. It does partly because Harry Potter's world is an interesting hybridic world, which is in a, should we say, a dimension that intersects with ours. No, dimension is not the word. But the thing there was that I have seven kids. And in Norway, we still read for our kids. So I read a lot of Harry Potter aloud. First, I read the whole thing in Norwegian for some people, and then some of the kids, and then I read the whole thing in English when they became older. And you know, it's the curse of an intellectual that you cannot do anything without starting analyzing it. So I suppose that was the explanation, that I'd read it anyway, and it was there, ripe for the being analyzed. So that was a great book to make, Dan. I think that was a fun book to write together.
So, it was a blast. But one of the things about that book, and which is this other dimension of your work in popular culture that I think is worth mentioning, is that you've been very concerned with the methodology of studying popular culture. It isn't just, you know, I want to go out and think about, you know, the sort of counterfactualism through speculative fiction or what have you, but there is this tie-in to your work on discourse analysis and on practices where I think popular culture and the how we study popular culture, there's a very rich kind of mutually informative relationship there. So I thought maybe a few words about that would be useful.
Yes. This also has partly to do with the division of labor inside academia. If you're in cultural studies, you can take any popular cultural artifact and you can analyze it for what it says, and that's the job. I don't think we as social scientists can do that. Our calling is simply a different one. Let me ease into this by evoking the literary critic and Shakespearean scholar Stephen Greenblatt, who talks about circulation between the stage, the theater stage, and the public. He has some pretty hairy examples of plays that are so successful that the actors are being killed because the public forgets that it's not for real. And this is what he calls circulation between between the theater scene and the public. And Greenblatt's idea of the job of the literary critic is to explain why it is that we find certain literary artifacts more enchanting than others. And his answer is that they take up in them life and problems that societies have at a certain stage, and then throw those problems back to the public in the shape of an artwork. And this, of course, to answer your question directly about the interface here, this, of course, shadows, this, of course, mirrors Foucault's idea that we should look at why things become a problem socially. Why is it that immigration becomes a huge problem at certain stages? Why is it that sexuality becomes a problem in this, that, and the other shape here and there? Not just say, here is a problem socially, how should we deal with it, but ask, where does that problem come from? Why was it that we made it into a problem in the first place, etc.? So these things, to me, come together in the study of popular culture, because what we should do is not what the literary theorist does, to say, how is it that this literary art captures how is it that this literary, what kind of social elements has this literary work taken up into itself so that it is so enchanted on this public? We should do it the other way around. We should say, why is it that the social is so interesting, social life is so interesting in this artifact? What is it about this artifact that makes it put its stamp on society? And why is it that exactly these and these and these social phenomena are taken up and thrown back at the public? So, you know, I think as social scientists, we should look at the same circuit of enchantment that Greenblatt looks at, but only from the opposite side, as it were. There's a book just around the corner on Battlestar Galactica, which would be a typical example of this. Why is it that the idea of a genocide and a fight against an invading force of our own making would be so enchanting to an American and a world public when Battlestar Galactica came? Well, it was right after 9/11, and snake and the bosom and all that way of metaphorically thinking about how you can hatch your own enemies will very much fit the Americans and Bin Laden, wouldn't it? If memory serves, I think George Bush Sr. Apologized to the president, his son, George W. Bush, for having given money to Bin Laden in the first place. And the story of Battlestar Galactica and how the Cylons hatched by the humans in the series, I think, play out similar stuff. So, I think it should be one of the businesses of social science to demonstrate how social stuff gets treated in literature and how that treatment in the literature or in the TV show, in this case, rebounds on the social, as it were, to analyze, to document and analyze that circulation.
One of the challenges of interviewing you about your work is that there's so much of it and it goes in so many different directions despite some themes throughout it. So before we do sign off, I wanted to ask you to talk a little bit about another project, from Harry Potter and Battlestar Galactica to the Central Asian steppe. You've been doing a lot of work on nomadic steppe formations in their history and politics. And you had a piece, I know, in the Journal of International Relations and Development, sort of calling a sort of manifesto, as it were, for how we ought to study pastoral nomads, whether they be just pastoring or, taking up composite bows and conquering the world. So I thought that you could tell us a little bit about that project.
You know that you reach a certain age when you can have your book proposals tweaked and then publish them as articles, Dan. It's a dubious pleasure because it means that you have become so good at your craft that you're probably about to die. But joking aside, my major interest remains the same throughout what we've been talking about. It's alterity and how alterity, how otherness, organized in different polities, lead to different ways of being in the world together. And I think that is at the core of international relations as such. That is the problematique in my work on Russia and Europe. It's how to handle it is the key question for diplomacy. It's that topic which draws me to certain kinds of popular culture artifacts like Battlestar Galactica, Star Trek, Harry Potter, where this is very much a key part of the plot. And this is also the question that led me to the Eurasian steppes, because it turns out that we have a whole set of polities in world history, namely steppe-based polities that have been astonishing degree neglected by social scientists. And I think the reason for that is that Hegel laid down as a law that a state had to be sedentary. And political science and also others studying politics have basically followed that adage. But there are other kinds of polities and states. And I remember you and Patrick Jackson had that wonderful 1999 article. I believe that was your first article then, wasn't it?
It was. Where indeed. You talk about, thank you, talk for about, saying it's a, you know, for saying nice things about it. But
yeah, I was about to. Yeah.
So this is a topic that's hugely neglected.
So it's hugely neglected because for one thing, social science that can call itself so must look at all possible variants of the of cases. You know, you want the full universe of cases, and national relations is supposed to be the social science that looks at relations between different polities. And here we have a number of polities that have never been studied. And on top of that, they are just not sort of tucked away in some obscure island or something. This is a tradition that went on for about 3,000, at least 3,000 years. And it was a tradition that was key to the making of European states in the first place. This is obvious when you look at somewhere like Bulgaria, where the very name of the state reflects that it's a conglomerate state of steppe people called the Bulgars and the conquered sedentary Slavs living in the area where the Bulgars moved in. It's also obvious in the case of Hungary and in the case of Russia. In the case of Turkey, it's slightly different. It's the steppe people that basically came in and set up shop all by themselves. Then, of course, there was hybridization by the local population and everyone who's had a look at present-day Turkish-Greek relations know that history isn't dead. But no one has looked systematically at this in IR. And I have a friend and student who is a Turkologist. And it was when I supervised his work on the Ottoman Empire, it struck me that someone should tell the story of the Eurasian steppe and its importance today, because the second part of the project will be to trace how the Eurasian steppe tradition was alive in the Turkish and Russian cases well into the 1800s. And I would argue that we could find certain remnants even today.
I'm thinking about, Jeremy Black and War in the World argues that the disappearance of competitive steppe formations is probably one of the most important transformations in global politics, that occurs sort of over the course of the 19th century and comparatively late in many respects to what we tend to think about it in a kind of state and heart of Europe centric model. So I'm really looking forward to that. I mean, you know that I've had an enduring interest in steppe formations myself, but I lack your linguistic skills, which is a major barrier to doing serious work on the subject, since work is spread out over so many languages and over so many national historical traditions.
Well, but you can take that any way you like, Dan. You can also say that since there are so many languages involved, who needs them? You know, you can always find collaborators that will help you with this. But I think if we should establish the Eurasian steppe and its importance, both as a tradition and as it pertains to sedentaries, as a central object in international relations, we need all men on board and all women on board, and that includes you, Dan. And I have high hopes for this new section inside the International Studies Association that will look at historical sociology and this kind of thing. So
that is being spearheaded by two of your former students, speaking of genealogies and grandfathers and great-grandfathers in the field.
Yes, that is one of the things about coming of age. I'm now the same age as my students. And that is that you take ever more interests and you are ever more proud of what your students are actually doing. And that is partly an egoistic thing, because they are the ones that keep you in touch with what's going on in the younger cohorts of the discipline. So to students who listen to this podcast, you know, you should never feel shy about asking your professor for help, because it's a two-way street, man. I mean, the professor gets help from hearing what you have read and which contexts you have been talking to about what as well. So we're all in this together. International relations is a community in the Burkean sense of being a community between the dead, the living, and the not yet born.
That sounds like a great note on which to end this. We didn't actually get into, I think, a very spirited discussion of contemporary international relations, which is something that I would like to have with you on a future podcast. So I know this was kind of a pain to schedule, but hopefully we can do a part two, where having gotten all of gotten a sense from this podcast about all of your, not only your intellectual history, but your very diverse and yet connected interests and area of study, we can start to kind of hit on some very contemporary themes and what you think about them. Thanks very much for coming on.
Well, thank you, Dan, and I'm looking forward to this because my next assignment is to write my inaugural lecture at the LSE, and it is called International Relations as a Social Science. So now I only have to get rid of this goddamn cold so I can start reading, because the deadline is the 13th of February. So again, to students who listen into this podcast, I mean, if you think that when you become the professor, you can simply relax and not think anymore of deadlines, you're wrong. They just become even harder to achieve, because there are so many other things and there is more and more at stake. So, you know, I'm now so nervous that I have to end, Dan. Okay. Bye now.
Well, happy holidays and Merry Christmas. And
to you and your family.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
That concludes episode 17 of the Duck of Minerva podcast. It was recorded on 21 December 2012 and featured Ivor Newman. This is Dan Nexon, and I don't have a good sign-off. So long.